A Lenten sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 24, 2002, in the series Journeying with Jesus on the Road Less Traveled, entitled The Road Taken Makes All the Difference. The readings for the sermon are from Luke 4, verses 1 through 14, and chapter 19, verses 35 through 44, and John 12, verses 12 through 28. The text for the sermon is John 12, verses 27 and 28. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I that I could not travel both. So said Robert Frost. For Robert Frost knew, contrary to the wisdom of Yogi Berra, that when you come to a fork in the road, you can't take it. You have to choose. And we've been following Jesus, journeying with Jesus this Lenten season on the road less traveled. And we come today to Jerusalem and the culmination of that way that he went. Because the road that we choose makes all the difference. The gospel portraits of Jesus are very clear in presenting him as one who lived with intentionality, with a strong sense of identity, following consistently a vision that led him to Jerusalem and finally to crucifixion. And so this morning we find him approaching and entering that holy city as the culmination of his ministry. Jesus did not begin at this point to make those choices that led him to death. For the Gospels are clear that he had been one who had been choosing the road less traveled consistently throughout his ministry. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all give us temptation narratives. Mark simply referring to it. Matthew giving a rather full account, and Luke, the account that was read a moment ago. The temptation story. Not a historical event. Not Jesus out in the wilderness for 40 days coming back and say, this is what happened. But Luke, who tells us in the opening verses of his gospel that he checked all the sources he could in order to get the fullest possible handle on this Jesus. This tradition that had grown now for Luke some five decades after the event itself. But Luke, when he wants to paint the portrait of Jesus, at the opening, at the onset of that ministry, records this mythical story of Jesus' encounter with the adversary, with Satan. Because the temptations that Jesus faced throughout all his ministry were clearly temptations to use his considerable power, well, to make a stone into bread, serving himself and perhaps socially the needs of people, using his considerable power to manipulate the political system and by compromise and expediency gain worldly acclaim. Or perhaps, charismatic that he was, using the religious community manipulatively, coercively, forcing belief through some dramatic action of one kind or another. And these were not These were not temptations that were there in the very beginning for Jesus, but Jesus wrestling from the beginning with those very possibilities which were always open to him. And Luke tells us that once that encounter was over, the devil left him for a more opportune time, indicating that Jesus was not yet done with the temptation to compromise that to which he was committed. Jesus was intentional about who he was and what he was called to do. John's Gospel tells us that he started out as a disciple of John the Baptist, teaching and preaching around the Jordan. But things weren't going so well there, and he thought it better to move on. And that probably represents more than just moving out of the territory. It probably represents his movement away from John the Baptist. John the Baptist, the fiery preacher of the judgment of God, looking for the wrath of God to be poured out on that people. Jesus, uneasy with that, finding for himself the model of the suffering servant in Isaiah, the model for his own person and his own ministry, moving up into Galilee in what is called the Galilean Spring. And Luke tells us that in the paragraph following the temptation story about how Jesus delivered the prisoners and caused the deaf to hear and the blind to see, Jesus initiating a ministry that was the embodiment of the grace of God, bringing joy and inspiration and healing and liberation to people. But then in the middle of Luke's Gospel, chapter 9, verse 51, Jesus set his face to go to Jerusalem. And now we see him there. I had Bob read the account in Luke's Gospel, even though I had listed John's account in the 12th chapter of John's Gospel. I was going to do John because I was going to point out that John's the only one that uses palms, and palms were a nationalistic symbol, and the people were receiving Jesus as a national hero, and they were ready for him to make some move to restore the dignity and the freedom of the nation. And his mounting the donkey in John's Gospel was his own action to correct their misconception of what he was about and who he was. But with things in Jerusalem as they are as we speak, I simply had to go back to Luke's account. For he comes into the city, the peaceable king. There aren't even any branches in Luke's account. And then he stands on the crest of Olivet and weeps over the city. If only you had known. If only you had known the things that make for peace. You've missed the moment of your visitation. And now it is hid from your eyes. And there will not be one stone left upon another. Once again, nobody was there with a stenographer's notebook, and nobody had their camera at the ready. But what Luke is telling us in placing Jesus there and putting those words in Jesus' mouth is that it was Jesus' way that led him to that point that would have looked over Jerusalem and would have seen the imminent devastation and ruination of that city and that people. For when Luke was writing his gospel, this was not prophetic. This was not foreknowledge of what was about to happen. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to know what was going to happen, as a matter of fact. But what Luke was doing 5 decades later, describing what actually happened. Because in the Roman-Jewish war of 66 to 70, the whole city was finally brought to absolute and utter ruin. Never again to be that place of the temple and the priesthood and the center of Jewish religious life. And so, Jesus comes to Jerusalem on this day to bring his message finally to the very center and the heart of the leadership of this people. And he can see what is going to happen. And I thought to myself, with what is happening in our world today, I can hardly not set that passage before you, because it does say what I have been trying to say in these Lenten weeks, both on Sundays and on Wednesday nights. And that is that there are two roads that Jesus took, the road less traveled, the way of God's inclusive grace and unconditional love and nonviolence. And that way is the only hope of the world. Jesus, as he stands before Jerusalem, is holding out the only hope of the world, and that is to find the way of peace. As we worship this morning, Jerusalem is burning. Hostility, terrorism, violence, and death is everywhere. And the situation there seems to be almost a carbon copy of that which was going on 2,000 years ago. Except today, the ones who are desperate, the ones who would do the foolish thing of challenging overwhelming power are the Palestinian people, aren't they? The Jewish people in 66 to 70, what chance did they have in their rebellion against Rome? Really none at all. It was an act of suicide. But people can get that desperate so that it doesn't matter. When they've lost everything, then they do the desperate thing, which has no hope at all of success, but which is the final sign of their utter frustration, anger, resentment, and hopelessness. We've not visited anything in this Lenten season that we haven't visited many times before. We probably haven't taken up any themes that we haven't reflected on together before. But somehow or other, in the wake of 9/11, it's all come so poignantly before us. It seems so fresh. It seems so contemporary. It seems like these events surrounding Jesus and Jerusalem are happening all over again in our world. And we see the ways that divide. There's business as usual. And business as usual has been the rule for the past 2,000 years, for the way of Jesus has not been followed. Business as usual is real politics. Business as usual is the imposition of force to coerce the settlement. Business as usual is that politics that uses whatever force is necessary in order to maintain the status quo or to return things to the status quo. And the use of force being necessary to accomplish that purpose, the imposition of force continues to be necessary in order to maintain that status quo. Because nothing really changes with the imposition of force. Hearts are not changed, minds are not changed, behavior is not changed. Rather, it is coerced. And so there is a lock put on it, and a maintenance of some measure of quietude, however that may be described. And the other way is the way of Jesus, the way of peace, which hasn't been tried. And the way of peace, which hasn't been tried, of course, is, well, it sounds so Pollyanna. It sounds rather ridiculous, doesn't it? It sounds like, it sounds like preacher talk. It's the kind of thing you expect to hear in church. But thank God, when you get to Monday morning, it's the real world. Whether you're in the corporate rat race, or whether you're in the military or political assignment or whatever it may be. Because the real world out there, the real world out there, doesn't take Jesus seriously. And yet, you know, when you think about Jesus, in spite of all of the darkness into which we are entering right now, Jesus was not a tragic figure. Jesus was a person of great joy. Jesus was an inspiring personality. Jesus was noted for his table fellowship, the camaraderie of the meal. Jesus was a healer. Jesus loved children. Jesus was a human being. Jesus lived a humane existence and created a humaneness about him. So, I grant you, it sounds silly to suggest in a world like ours, post 9/11, focused even now in the Middle East and in Jerusalem, it sounds silly to talk about the way of Jesus, doesn't it? And yet, you know, when you stop to think about it, the way of Jesus, well, Jesus himself and who he was and what he embodied, has anyone in history impacted human behavior more? Has anyone made a difference in the world more than Jesus? And when someone did take him seriously, like Gandhi, look what was affected. And in our own country, in the civil rights era of Martin Luther King, that way of nonviolent resistance, I mean, for 2,000 years, it's been business as usual, pretty much. And here we are. And you know, we could destroy ourselves. We really could. How much into a corner does Israel have to be shoved before they use nuclear capability? You say, oh, they're smarter than that. What if it is existence or being driven into the sea? And what if, as some young Egyptian student suggested, that a suitcase-sized nuclear bomb could eliminate the problem of Israel? And what if that situation continues to escalate until it becomes a civilizational war, which astute commentators are speaking of? we could bring this planet back to the Stone Age, where the only thing that would be alive would be some moss on a rock somewhere. Well, I suppose that sounds also like dramatic pulpit rhetoric, but it really isn't. Our world is really in crisis, and business as usual, real politic, the imposition of force, the exercise of power, has brought us to the brink of disaster. And so Jesus, the Pollyanna, Jesus, the silly, unrealistic idealist, there he stands, looking at Jerusalem, and saying, "You missed your chance. And now it's hid from your eyes." And that's the way it is with us. We can get to a point where we just can't see anymore. And then just awful things can happen. So, Jesus, I don't know Jesus, but I wonder if with the internet, for example, if you could come back, if you or somebody like you could get on the internet, could begin to filter this around the world, could somehow or other grab the attention of the whole global community of people who essentially are people of goodwill, and take it out of the hands of the power brokers, and let the people speak. I just wonder whether there aren't people, multitudes. I wonder if there isn't somebody somewhere that could embody again that which Jesus embodied. Because you see, the world is before a fork in the road. Two ways, two roads diverge in the yellow wood. And we have to choose which one we'll follow.